Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchak. Today we take you to the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor for a talk by former U.S. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. This talk is one of many from the 2020 Champlain Institute, whose theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? The title of today's talk is The Reach of History. We'll hear his thoughts on the historical roots of several of the critical challenges facing our country today. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Lynn Bolger, Dean of Institutional Advancement at COA and Director at the Champlain Institute.
Welcome to this bonus session of the Champlain Institute, where special guest speaker Senator George Mitchell will join us. If you live in the United States, you probably know who Senator Mitchell is. If you live in Maine, you definitely do. And if you live on Mount Desert Island, you've probably met him. Most people will know a little bit about Senator Mitchell. He's a Bowdoin grad, then went to the U.S. Army, Georgetown Law, and then to the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. He was executive assistant for Senator Muskie and then became a senator himself. He has had the reputation of being the most respected politician in the country by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. And in 1994, Senator Mitchell was offered the open seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, but declined, saying he would want to devote his time to health care reform. Think of that. That was 30 years ago. But I think what most people want to know about people in power, stars in their field, and celebrities is, what are they like? Are they the real deal? I met Senator Mitchell in 2016 when he was speaking at the Institute for the first time. As you might imagine, there are a lot of back and forth conversations, forms to complete, blurbs to approve, and some people are very busy and important, and they don't always respond in a timely way. But George Mitchell did, and I remembered that. Since then, I have gotten to know Senator Mitchell a little bit as he has become a friend to the Institute, helping recruit speakers we otherwise would never have the ability to secure, and giving us advice whenever we asked. I am always nervous around him because this is a man who helped broker the Good Friday Peace Agreement and served as United States Senator from Maine for 15 years. And as the majority leader for 6. He's written numerous books and has authored 2 reports called the Mitchell Reports, one on the Arab-Israel conflict and one on the use of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. It's very impressive, and I think I am not alone in saying that the more impressive a person is, the more intimidating it is to be around them. You, with your very humble background and CV. But George Mitchell almost always puts people at their ease immediately. He is kind and courteous, the way David Rockefeller was kind and courteous, meaning always, no matter who was around and who isn't around. But unlike Mr. Rockefeller, George Mitchell was a working-class Maine kid. His mother was an immigrant from Lebanon. His father, an Irish orphan, also an immigrant. He was a janitor at Colby. His speeches, Senator Mitchell's speeches, tonight's included, focus on the promise that is America. My mother is a first-generation American. Her mother, a French-Canadian immigrant who worked in a Lewiston shoe mill. My grandfather was also American, an immigrant from French-speaking Canada, and a tradesman. My father was a roofer and never graduated high school. There are so many of us in America who, as he says, grab the bottom rung of the American dream and haul themselves up. George Mitchell believes in families like mine. He still fights for and writes about families like mine. When he speaks about the middle class and the poor in America, and what we, as the greatest nation in the world, could do to help the most vulnerable among us, he means it. He's lived it, and he has worked for it all of his life. George Mitchell's birthday is next month. He will be 87. He is a national treasure, and I am honored to welcome him back to the Champlain Institute. Many happy returns, Senator Mitchell. You are the real deal.
Thank you, Lynn, for that kind introduction. I congratulate the College of the Atlantic, Darren Collins, Lynn Bolger, and their team at COA on another outstanding program. I'm grateful to be able to again participate. Each generation of Americans has faced daunting challenges. So it is today, as we confront the combined effects of several crises: racial justice, immigration, the coronavirus, the effects of globalization, climate change. Less tangible, but also of great concern, is the crisis of our national spirit, the intense polarization, the loss of hope and optimism, the weakening of our commitment to all of our fellow Americans. Some of these challenges go back to our nation's founding, some even further. Some are recent. All are serious. I will discuss each, and to help better understand them, I will try to place them in historical context. Human beings first appeared on Earth about 300,000 years ago in what is now Africa. For most of the time since then, they lived as nomads, in small groups, hunting and gathering each day for food. It was only about 10,000 years ago in what we now refer to as the Middle East that agriculture and fixed places of living first developed. Significant changes followed. Spoken language expanded, writing began, numbers were first used, the wheel was invented, animals were domesticated, the family became the basic unit of society. As a result, human life changed dramatically and irrevocably. For most people, life improved, but there were severe adverse effects as well. Among them were disease and slavery. The mingling of people and domesticated animals created an opening for the transmission of disease, and that has resulted in periodic pandemics that have killed millions of people. The effects were accelerated by increases in population, in both numbers and density. The world's population did not reach 1 billion until the 19th century. The most recent billion, the seventh, was added in just 13 years. Although the rate of increase has slowed, the absolute numbers continue to rise. The population will reach 10 billion between the middle and the end of this century. The specialization of labor that followed the development of agriculture and the growth of cities led to different values for different forms of work. Gradually, some groups decided that the less valued work could be performed at lower cost by someone from outside the group, often those defeated in conflict, and slavery began. The dispersal of humans out of Africa took place very slowly, first to Europe and Asia, and then gradually around the globe. It was not until about 15,000 years ago that small groups from Central Asia entered North America across the land bridge that then connected Siberia and Alaska. They eventually spread out over all of North and South America and are known to us as the Native Americans. About 500 years ago, Europeans crossed the Atlantic. For nearly three centuries, the Spanish, the British, the French, and the Dutch fought among themselves and with numerous Native American tribes for control of the Americas. We Americans traditionally date the European colonization of North America to the British settlement at Jamestown, Virginia, in 1607. Just 12 years later, the first shipload of African slaves arrived in Virginia. They were not the first slaves in the Americas. Over the previous century, Spanish explorers and settlers had enslaved many Native Americans. And then in 1620, the Mayflower, filled with pilgrims, landed in Massachusetts. So in the space of just 13 years, the foundations were laid in America for the four centuries of rapid growth, extraordinary change, and racial conflict that followed. The consequences remain with us today. Every American, every single one, is derived from someone who came here from somewhere else, starting with the Native Americans, and continuing to this day. After our country was founded, many came from Europe, from Asia, then from almost every part of the world. The vast majority came voluntarily, even eagerly, searching for freedom and opportunity. Most of them encountered hostility, stereotyping, and demonizing. On the basis of religion, Jews especially, but also Catholics and Muslims. On the basis of national origin, Irish, Italian, Polish, Japanese, Chinese, Mexican, and those from other Latin American countries. But despite the hostility, most of them got their hands on the bottom rung of the ladder of American success, and they lifted themselves up mainly through education. In that effort, for most people, the family was indispensable to success. In retrospect, whatever difficulty these groups endured pale in comparison to the experiences of the Native Americans and the African Americans. The Native Americans were nearly exterminated. Historians' estimates range from 15 to 50 million deaths, many from diseases brought to the Americas by Europeans. Today, the remaining tribes struggle to survive on reservations. My mother was an immigrant. She could not read or write English. My father was the orphan son of immigrants. He did not finish grammar school, and he worked his whole life as a laborer and a janitor. Yet, each of their children graduated from college and were able to lead lives our parents could not have imagined, all in a single generation. That is the America of openness, of opportunity, of freedom, that has been so incredibly good to most of us and that we all are so proud of. That is the real life experience of millions of immigrants and their descendants, except for African Americans. They were the only group that came to America involuntarily, in chains, as slaves. for nearly 250 years, they remained in slavery, denied not only their freedom, but also education or any opportunity to improve themselves or their conditions. In some places, it was a crime to teach a black person to read or to write. After slavery was abolished, for another century, they were subjected to organized discrimination in all aspects of their lives. They were effectively denied the right to vote, all of it devised, sanctioned, and enforced by state governments. One of the harsh effects of slavery was the destruction of many families. Children were separated from their parents, husbands from wives, sisters from brothers. For centuries, most other immigrants relied upon their families to help them through their hard times. For many slaves, there was no family. There now appears to be widespread support among Americans for meaningful changes in the way African Americans are treated in our system of justice. That is long overdue. Real and meaningful action is essential, but it cannot be achieved in isolation. There also must be equality of opportunity in health care, in education, and in work. The challenge we face is to translate these broadly supported principles into meaningful laws that command wide political support. That will not be easy in our polarized politics, but public support seems to be growing. It must happen, and soon. Immigration continues. Millions of people still want to come to America. Obviously, there must be realistic limits on how many can enter and who they are. But unfortunately, recently the emphasis has been on who we should keep out and who we should throw out. But we also should focus on who we want to enter, on how we can continue to replenish our society with new people to their benefit and ours. We must work together on how we can do that and live up to our principles as a just, open, and welcoming society. In 2013, the United States Senate approved, by a large bipartisan margin, a compromise immigration bill written by a group of senators from both parties. It also was supported by a bipartisan majority in the House of Representatives. If brought up to a vote in the House, it would have become law. But the then Speaker of the House refused to permit a vote on it, so the bill was never voted on, even though it had the support of a majority of the House and had passed the Senate by a bipartisan majority. The bill was imperfect, as are all legislative compromises, but it would have been a significant improvement over the current system, and it offered the hope that some progress is possible, even on difficult issues in difficult times. There are an estimated 11 million illegal immigrants in the United States. A majority of them entered legally with valid visas, most through major commercial airports, but they did not leave when their visas expired. So we should be investing in a 21st century system of tracking that would help us better understand and deal with this issue. Some urge that we seek out better educated and higher qualified immigrants. That's a worthy objective, and to a significant but not well-known extent, it's already the case. Currently, most legal immigrants are from Asia, not from Latin America, and about half of them already have college degrees, a far higher rate than for Americans who were born here. From the very beginning, our country has been enriched by new people, new ideas, new energy, new vision. That continues. 6 of the 7 American recipients of the 2016 Nobel Prizes were immigrants. 3 of the most valuable and most successful business enterprises in the world are Apple, Amazon, and Google. Apple was created by Steve Jobs, whose father was born in Syria. Amazon was created by Jeff Bezos, whose adoptive father was born in Cuba. A co-founder of Google, Sergey Brin, was himself born in Russia. Ask yourself, would we be a better country if they had not been admitted? And what do you think the chances are that if Steve Jobs had lived his life in Syria, he would have created Apple? Or Jeff Bezos in Cuba? Or Sergey Brin in Russia? Genius knows no language, no race, no religion. It can be found wherever human beings exist. But it is more likely to flourish where there is freedom, education, and opportunity for all, where innovation is encouraged and success is celebrated. That's our aspiration for the United States. We Americans have made many mistakes, and we've been through some very tough times. But we have emerged from every crisis a bigger, better, stronger, more diverse, more free country. Our economy is still the largest and the strongest in the world. Our military strength is unequaled. We're now going through a dangerous phase in our history. Despite the many difficulties, as we respond, we should not underestimate the basic strength of our people and of our economy. Most historians regard the Industrial Revolution as one of the major turning points in human history. It began 250 years ago in England. As machines replaced men, there was widespread fear that unemployment would rise to unacceptably high levels. There was fear, anxiety, violent resistance, social upheaval. There was some misery and exploitation, but there also was an increase in productivity so dramatic that the standard of living rose for the entire society. Today, we're struggling with the consequences of a new revolution in technology and communications. Its effects are intensified by a dramatic increase in global trade and in the movement of people across national borders. As a result, there's been a massive and unprecedented increase in wealth, but the benefits are increasingly concentrated in a relatively few people at the top and are not being felt through the whole society. We have not figured out how to replace the millions of middle-class, middle-income jobs that have been lost. The success of democracy is dependent on a thriving middle class. But today, in the United States, our middle class is not thriving. Technology has led to an increase in productivity by industrial workers. So even as output has risen, the number of jobs in many industries has declined. The economic value of skilled and college-educated workers has risen, while for those with high school or less education, it has fallen. The search for lower-cost workers has become a worldwide enterprise, far different from the localized effort it was for so long. This is not new. Over and over again in our history, innovation and technological change have resulted in social upheaval and the disruption, even the destruction of entire industries. The shift from whale oil to oil destroyed the whaling industry. The invention of the automobile destroyed the horse-drawn carriage industry. The benefits were nationwide. The adverse effects were local, largely in New England. The answer cannot be to deny science and to stifle innovation. Rather, it must be to harness science and change to our benefit. Among the greatest challenges of the 21st century is to devise and adopt policies that will allow us to reap the benefits of science, advanced knowledge, and technology, while at the same time mitigating the adverse effects on so many of our fellow citizens who are victims, not beneficiaries, of technological change. That must begin with a massive and unified national effort to provide good health care and good education to every American child, and to make available to all of our citizens the skills needed to compete in the 21st century. Now, in the inevitable and necessary shift from a carbon to a non-carbon-based economy, we must recognize and take advantage of the vast job potential in clean energy. Since it came into existence, the Earth has gone through phases of warming and cooling, the result of natural forces like volcanic eruption and variations in the amount of naturally occurring greenhouse gases. But the warming of the past century has been more rapid than ever. According to NASA, the influence of natural causes is too small to account for the warming of the past few decades. What does explain it is the dramatic increase in greenhouse gases emitted by humans. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concluded that the concentration of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxides have increased to levels unprecedented in at least the last 800,000 years. The burning of coal, oil, and gas for transportation, heat, cooling, and electricity is the primary source of human-generated emissions. Although oceans and forests absorb gases from the atmosphere, they have been unable to keep up with rising emissions. These are facts acquired and reinforced by scientific inquiry and research, all widely published and accepted by the overwhelming majority of scientists in the world today. If there is not a strong international response, the consequences will be devastating, especially in large coastal cities. Among the adverse results already occurring are polluted air, drought, storms, floods, and a huge increase in poor migrants fleeing such events. There will be huge losses economically, and there also will be much sickness and premature death. The World Health Organization has estimated that climate change is expected to cause approximately 250,000 additional deaths each year between 2030 and 2050. There is room for legitimate, even necessary debate on how to respond to this crisis. Because the Earth is warming does not mean that every suggestion to deal with it makes sense. We should now be engaged in that debate in the U.S. and around the world. But that debate is not taking place, primarily because some in our country insist that there is no such thing as global warming, and they oppose any serious effort to deal with it. This denial of science is not just wrong, it's dangerous to the people of this country and of the world. To the people of Maine, this is not a distant threat. It is as real and as close as the nearby ocean. In 2015, 5 years ago, the Portland Press Herald published a series of reports on the Gulf of Maine, and they began with these words. Since 2004, the Gulf of Maine has warmed faster than any place on the planet, except for a small area northeast of Japan. I have confidence in America and in Americans. I believe that science and reason will prevail over fear and looking backward. I believe we must, we can, and we will devise policies to deal with these and the many other challenges we will confront in the coming decades. For over two centuries, America has stood, albeit imperfectly, for freedom and opportunity. That has made it possible for most of us participating in this conference to lead lives of relative ease, largely insulated from the harsh winds of life by our families, our education, our resources, the webs of friendship and influence we have woven over a lifetime. It is in our interest to make those opportunities available to all Americans. To do so, we must return to and be true to our principles. Our democratic ideals distinguished our nation from the beginning, and they have appealed to people all around the world. They still do. Our economic strength and our military power are necessary and important, but our ideals have been and still are the primary basis of American influence in the world. They're not easily summarized, but surely they include the sovereignty of the people, the primacy of individual liberty, an independent judicial system, the rule of law applied equally to all citizens and to the government itself, and opportunity for every member of society. We must never forget the United States was a great nation long before it was a great economic or military power. Despite the current mood of intense political polarization, of widespread distress and despair, I believe we can and we will make progress on meeting these challenges. Perhaps imperfectly, too little for some, too much for others, but we will make real progress. I believe that our people and our institutions are resilient. If there is one trait that Americans have demonstrated throughout our history, it is the capacity to acknowledge, to confront, and to mitigate the adverse effects of our errors. All human beings and all human institutions are fallible. All of us make mistakes. Lots of them, large and small. Even the greatest of our leaders, with the best of intentions, made serious errors of judgment, some with deadly, terrible consequences. But time and again, we have recognized our mistakes, taken steps to correct them, or at least to lessen their impact. Finally, we must especially work to more fully realize the aspiration of opportunity for all. In our society, no one should be guaranteed success, but everyone should have a fair chance to succeed. From the experience of our daily lives, we know that equal opportunity for all Americans remains an aspiration. We must make it a reality. We must raise our actions to the level of our aspirations. Every American child should have the care, early development, and education to to enable them to rise as high and as far as their talent and their willingness to work will take them. Our goal should be a society which encourages striving and celebrates success, is conducive to innovation, and enables us to benefit from the talent, the energy, and the skill of every American, regardless of race or religion or heritage. That's our challenge. We must make it our destiny.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk by former U.S. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He recently spoke at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor as part of the 2020 Champlain Institute. This year's theme was November 3rd, What's at Stake? Stay tuned for more Speaking in Maine programs featuring talks from this year's Champlain Institute. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.